Advent. We are in the third week of Advent, and I think if we were to sum up kind of what we're trying to do this Advent season is maybe to ask a little bit different questions. And so I recently heard someone in an interview, and they said the question isn't, should we read the sacred texts? Because we are, as cultures, reading the sacred texts. The more important question is, how do we read them? Which I thought was pretty profound. And I might add on to some of those. The question isn't, do you believe in God? The more important question is, how do you define God? So we're very consumed with, do you believe in God? Do you believe in God? Well, how do you define God? And maybe with Advent, the question isn't, do we believe a Savior was born 2,000 years ago? But maybe more importantly would be, what does a Savior look like? Or what does a God look like? And we've been talking a lot about maybe their story, Mary and Joseph, the Advent story being a bit of our story in this sense of delivering Jesus in some metaphorical, symbolic way. And that's a really kind of vague, mysterious thing to talk about, and it's good, but what does that actually look like? And what are some things where we could say, oh yeah, I think this is happening, or maybe this isn't happening? Because I think we get really confused on our concepts of God and theology and Jesus and spirituality. So maybe this morning we can twist again and just talk about some things. What does it look like to deliver a Savior to the world, going off of the Advent story? And I wanted to start with a story that I think we've shared here before from Richard Rohr. I've shared it at least, but it's one of those I want to remember every day. Richard Rohr was at a monastery, and there was a recluse there who basically has taken a vow of silence and speaks maybe once a year. And so he saw this man, Richard Rohr's out on a walk, and he saw him approaching him, and he thought, oh my goodness, I need to be really quiet. I don't want to force him to talk or anything, so I'll just kind of stand here and let him approach me. And as the man came up, he said, Richard, I know that you talk to people, you preach to people around the world, and I don't get to. So I need you to tell them one thing, just one thing. Okay, what? God is not out there. Now, when monks, recluse, who take vow of silence and pray far more than I probably have in my life in 1 year, say things, it's really important that we listen to what they say. And when they say, I have one thing to say that sums up everything, and that one thing is, God is not out there, that's really important. Because I think we know it. Well, yeah, God's not out there. But do we really know it? Because if God is not out there, then where is God? So here are some ideas on that, maybe you could say. Start with Jeremiah. Am I a God who is near, declares the Lord, and not a God far off? Can a man hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him, declares the Lord? Do I not fill the heavens and the earth? So again, if you were just to look at this, and this is probably poetic in nature, but even to look at what it is saying and ask most Christians or most spiritual people, do you believe this? Not theoretically in your brain, but I mean really. This God is not far off, is not near. This God, you cannot hide from this God, which means this God is everywhere. Everywhere. So maybe you could say, yeah, this God is not out there because that's the only place we always think this God is. But this God is out there and here and everywhere else. Is this God really everywhere? And what are the implications of that? I mean, we really thought through that. Everywhere. Anthony DeMello, one of my favorites, says it this way. The fact is you're surrounded by God and you don't see God because you know about God. So you're surrounded by God, but you don't see God because you know about God. The final barrier to the vision of God is your God concept. You miss God because you think you know. Right? You gotta love this stuff, people. Quiet this morning. You miss God because you think you know. You're swimming in God. You're the fish in the ocean. It doesn't know the water's there. You are surrounded by God. I'm like, where's God in all of this? Where's God in this person? Where's God? Everywhere. And the final thing that needs to die is your concept of God. Because this concept is destroying your awareness of it. And often this is the danger of religion and church, because it feeds a false concept that actually prevents people from ever being aware of the God they're trying to worship. So I came across this quote as well, and this one was a little interesting, a little more a conservative commentary. God is everywhere at all times, and he, of course, inhabits, dwells in eternity. There is no place to go where God is not. For the believer, that is comforting. And I thought, wow, there we go. Beautiful. There's no place to go where God is not. For the unsaved, that will be terrifying. For it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Wait, what? What does that mean? It started off so great. God is everywhere. And it is beautiful. You cannot escape God if you're a believer. Now, for the other people, this is going to be terrifying. But wait. Why is it terrifying? Is God really mean to unbelievers and really nice to the believers? This God that's everywhere, in everything, is God in unbelievers? Because it says there's no place to go where God is not. And again, this speaks to these concepts of God, and you see this kind of stuff everywhere. And this, to me, is why people are so confused with spirituality and experiencing God. Because all of these concepts and words and theologies, and God is everywhere, and it's so beautiful, unless, then it is terrifying. You will fall into the hands of the living God. I thought the hands of the living God were love and mercy and compassion and grace and inspiration. Well, yeah, for some people, but not for you. It's so confusing. Am I supposed to be comforted or terrified? And again, over and over, these concepts of God. God is everywhere. God is here. God is there. You're saved. You're not. Terrified. Comforted. All right, so let's maybe just go to the Christmas story and at least find something we can hang our hats on. A few little things that I thought of this morning that might be worth illustrating some good concepts. Okay. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. This is Mary we're talking about here, if you haven't caught on. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger, because there was no guest room available for them. The angel said, "You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." So here's what I wanted to highlight first. If this story is about some kind of God, divine, coming into the universe in a more explicit way than we've known up to this point. We've heard this before, but it is amazing that God shows up as a baby. We're talking a baby here. Is there a baby here this morning? There probably is some babies. A lot of newborns around this branches. Babies, you guys, have you looked at a baby recently? Have you thought about Jesus, Son of God, being born? I mean, you can get graphic, it's fine. You can think about it. A human baby coming into the world, helpless. The baby needed to be wrapped. The baby needed to be cared for. The baby needed to be nursed. The baby needed to be held. And, you know, that neck that always wants to bend. Jesus had to have his head held so his neck wouldn't fall back. I mean, Son of God done right there. Oh my gosh, Joseph, don't you know how to hold a baby? A baby. The God of the universe, the divine, coming in a very explicit form as a baby. One of the smallest things we can imagine. I was reading an article called, the title, Salmon Sex Moves Mountains. That is a great headline for any of you journalism majors. Salmon sex moves mountains. And here's the story. Over millions of years, mountains with streams where salmon come to spawn, and they stir up the bottom of the streams, actually moves mountains by 30% more than mountains where salmon do not spawn. You know those Jesus stuff, by faith you'll move mountains? Say to that mountain over here. Yeah, there's some metaphor going on there. A salmon, are you kidding me? A fish this big, swimming upstream, spawning, dying, over and over, countless fish over millions of years moves a mountain. This is the kind of small that we miss out on so often. And it's so beautiful to have this concept of this massive God in the universe, which I love and I'm all in. But there's also this small God of the universe that moves mountains through consistent, small, individual things like you just smiling at someone. I don't know if you guys heard this, but in Japan, a subway or train left 20 seconds early. Yeah, 20 seconds early. And it basically sent the nation into panic. So the train had to apologize. On November 14th at approximately 9:44 a.m., a northbound Metropolitan Inner City Railway Company, main office in Tokyo, Chiyoda Ward, President and CEO Kochi Yugi, train left Minami, I'm not even going to try that, station, roughly 20 seconds earlier than the time indicated on the timetable. We deeply apologize for the severe inconvenience imposed upon our customers. This is Japan. This is the East. Can you imagine a New York City subway? Like 20, what? I don't even know. It's within 5 minutes. 20 seconds early, we deeply and humbly apologize for the inconvenience. But this is a culture with words like shokunin and kamiwaza. And these words are words that we don't even have really in our culture, and which is why the East is so important. These words of craftsmanship, of working like a god, of the small details. We've talked about sushi here. We've talked about rice. We've talked about yoga and this daily, small practice over and over and over and perfecting it over and never quite being good enough, but always getting a little better. And you eventually become a master craftsman or craftswoman who has ability like the gods. That's the kind of God that we're also talking about in this story. And sometimes we get so caught up in, I've got to deliver a son to the world. I mean, I've got to deliver the bright sun. They're going to see the sunrise. Well, they're just going to be awed by me. No. Sometimes all we need to do is that small little thing that is just on a consistent basis and practice it and do it better. And that is the birth of the divine. As much as anything, arguably more than anything. Because imagine if people who actually follow Jesus and this God were like those salmon. Small, little things over and over through thousands of years. It would move mountains. The problem is so many of us spend our days looking for this big, I'm going to put a billboard up and I'm going to invite 10,000 people and we're going to baptize 9,000 of them and it's going to move mountains. Maybe all we need to do is encourage 10,000 people to just go smile at somebody they didn't smile at the day before and show them the divine that way. We'd start actually delivering change and inspiration to this world. So this divine is small. Don't forget. I want to read that passage again because there's a whole other part of it. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger. Let's get back to this idea of a baby. Yes, it's small. It's also very human. So let's think about this again. We talk often about the incarnation, and the incarnation is beautiful because God is not out there. God is here. But it's, again, one of those things that we think we have a grasp on until we really think about the humanity of it. And maybe this story is more about humanity than divine sometimes. She gave birth to the Son of God. A woman did. Was she an angelic woman? No, she was a woman like every other woman. Arguably, probably 12 or 13 or 14. A young girl. A human gives birth in all the ways that humans give birth. There was nothing magic about this birth. I know there's immaculate conception, and if you want to go there, that's fine, but there's not immaculate birth. It was bloody, and it hurt, and there was an umbilical cord. And the baby had to have its first breath. And the baby had to be rubbed, say warm, and the baby had to have that stuff cleaned off of it. And Mary had to deliver a placenta. And you're going, Ryan, we get birth. Do we, though? We're talking about Jesus in full humanity being born like all of us were. I've been on this Father G kick. I don't know why. He has a new book out. And man, this guy, if you have not, Greg Boyle, Homeboy Industries, if you've not read anything from him, you need to this week. Or buy it somebody for Christmas. I was listening to him in an interview, and he said this: I think we're afraid of the incarnation. And part of it, the fear that drives us, is that we have to have our sacred in a certain way. It has to be gold-plated and cost millions and cost of millions and cast of thousands or something. I don't know. So we've wrestled the cup out of Jesus' hand, and we've replaced it with a chalice. Because who doesn't know that a chalice is more sacred than a cup? Never mind that Jesus didn't use a chalice. We're afraid of the incarnation. He goes on to tell a story of a gang member who was abused, abandoned as a kid, and it came to Christmas Day, and he told Father G, he said, you know what I did on Christmas? I invited seven enemies over to my house. We cooked a turkey. I'm like, well, how'd you cook a turkey? And he said, well, put it in the oven, some lemon, some salt and pepper, tasted great. We all sat there and we stared at the oven. We didn't even talk to each other because we didn't really know what to say. But when the turkey came out, we sat around a table and we ate together. And Father G said, what is more sacred than seven enemies eating a turkey on Christmas Day together? And he said, I don't think Jesus loses sleep that we'll forget the sacredness of the Eucharist, but that we will forget the ordinary. And I might add, I don't think God loses sleep that we forget Jesus was divine. I think God loses sleep we forget Jesus was human. Because Jesus seemed to say, when you see someone hungry, you see me. In fact, that is me. When you see someone thirsty, that is me. When you see someone in jail, that is me. When you see someone who doesn't have clothes, that is me. When you see someone at Branches, that is me. When you see someone on TV, that is me. When you see a politician, that is me. When you see somebody on the street, that is me. When you see the driver who cuts you off, that is me. When you see the person at Target who checks you out, that is me. When you see someone across the desk from you at work, that is me. When you see someone on Christmas morning opening presents and smiling, that is me. When you see someone serving you at a restaurant, that is me. When you see a master chef at a restaurant, that is me. I mean, are we getting this? That is me. That is me. You are Jesus. 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 You. When was the last time you even looked at each other like, hey, Jesus, what do you have to tell me today? I was going to have a little meditation where we actually have to talk to each other and actually pretend they're Jesus. And how hard it is even to see Jesus in someone. Lest you know, I'm a hypocrite. I was on a nice walk with my wife Friday. It was snowing. It was beautiful. Just a gorgeous little walk. Peaceful, quiet. We're just walking hand in hand, having great conversations about this message. We come upon a man snowblowing. Snowblowing his sidewalk. And he had snowblowed about two-thirds of it, and there was kind of this one little path here, and I thought, oh, that's, you know, we'll just walk, and he was just kind of there, and he didn't like, oh, hey, I mean, other people, hi, good afternoon, isn't it beautiful, yeah, it's so nice, oh, yeah, this guy, so we walked, okay, we'll just ignore him, And the snow-blown sidewalk ended, and it was just snow, like 4 inches of snow, right? You all were outside. A lot of snow. So we take a couple more steps. Hey, stop walking on my grass. Heidi turns around. Excuse me? Stop walking on my grass. I turn around. Dude, you need to chill out. What are you talking about? This guy. Where do you live? Maybe I'll go walk on your grass. Me. Please do. It's right there. Oh my God. Can you? What a complete. Oh my God. What kind of a. I cannot believe that. Does he, there are rocks right there. We rocked there all summer. There's not even grass. There's rock. And also, I wouldn't care if he came and snowblowed my lawn right now. It's 4 inches of snow. It's not going to harm the stupid grass. 5 minutes later, after our quiet, peaceful, you know, I wonder, man, he must not be having a good day. Maybe it was under 5 minutes, because later we were proud of ourselves. That it was maybe 2 minutes. Like, you know, they say around the holidays, people who are the most angry had the most hurtful lives. And maybe, who knows, maybe his wife just passed away. Maybe his kids aren't coming home. Maybe as a child, he was put into an orphanage, and Christmas is a really hard time of year for him. Maybe he wishes he could go on a walk with his wife, and she's too sick, or she's not around, or they're divorced. Or who knows the story, and even seeing us made him mad. Oh, man, we should have gone back and just, yeah. So, I mean, I'm like 2 minutes away from enlightenment, you guys. I mean, it only took me 2 minutes. But this is the beauty of the incarnation. When we really get it. That guy, that's Jesus. Jesus said, when you've seen the man snow blowing and he yells at you, and you go back and say, hey, Merry Christmas, I'm sorry, then you've done it to me. All right, Jesus, I'm not quite there yet. That's the beauty of the incarnation. And just so you know, love happens when we start seeing Jesus in every human being. I mean, that, struggle with that first, then love just comes. It's so hard to love people, it's hard to love this person, that person. Yeah, you just start seeing Jesus in everyone and love will arrive. Hope, joy, peace, love, the Advent season. See the incarnation and what it actually means, the humanity of it. All right, one last thing. On the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, right there we have a lot of humanity, he was named Jesus, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or 2 young pigeons. When Joseph and Mary had done everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own town of Nazareth, and the child grew and became strong. So we have a lot of small, we have a lot of humanity. We have something else. Wait. Jesus had to undergo purification rites required by the law of Moses? You guys, it's Jesus. I don't think you really need to go through the stuff, right? I mean, Son of God, whole thing. Messiah. Every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice. What, Jesus had to be consecrated to the Lord? Jesus had to be circumcised? Jesus had to go to the temple? His mom and dad performed these ceremonies that we don't even do anymore because we know they're not really that important and never really were. Jesus had to undergo them. And to me, what this brings out is culture and its importance. And there's 2 sides to this. One is culture matters. It matters that we have Sunday morning services at 10 and we sing a little bit and then we hear a sermon and we light some Advent candles. It matters. Why? Because our culture tells us it does. And sometimes we see God through cultural rituals. And that is beautiful. And apparently, Mary and Joseph with the Son of God even did the cultural rituals. Because it matters, and God sometimes shows up more clearly in them. But the other side of it is, culture changes. So those cultural rituals that were great 1,000 years ago aren't so great today. And that's okay, because this divine comes into culture and works within culture and moves culture and shows up in certain cultural rites over here and over here and over here. And you can't start saying, well, that one's wrong and this one's right, because this God is everywhere. I'm reading this amazing book about food, The Language of Food, in which I'm learning all kinds of things. Oh, man, it's so fun. One I learned recently, fish and chips. Where did fish and chips come from? Well, it's a whole chapter, so I'm not going to explain it to you. But I am going to summarize the chapter in this last paragraph, which is one of the most well-crafted paragraphs I've ever seen. Okay, ready? Here we go. And of course, this isn't about food. Just put this into a spiritual context or a religious context. This family of dishes that are claimed by many nations as cultural treasures, ceviche in Peru, chili in Ecuador, fish and chips in Britain, tempura in Japan, escabeche in Spain, asvik in France, were prefigured by the ancient Ishtar worshippers of Babylon, invented by the Zoroastrian Persians, perfected by the Muslim Arabs, adopted by the Christians, fused with Moche dishes by the Peruvians, and brought to Asia by the Portuguese and to England by the Jews. And you can now find all these descendants of Sikbi, I don't even know how you pronounce it, I looked it up, sometimes on the same block in the ethnic restaurants that fill San Francisco and other bustling cities around the world. Okay, so you have four different cultures who say, this is our dish. That's not how you make XYZ. That's not how you make it. We know how to make it. Well, all of them evolved from some previous dish, ancient Babylon, basically. Final paragraph. I'd like to think that the lesson here is that we are all immigrants, that no culture is an island, that beauty is created at the confusing and painful boundaries between cultures and peoples and religions. You guys, beauty is created at the confusing and painful boundaries between cultures and peoples and religions. I guess we can only look forward to the day when the battles we fight are about nothing more significant than where to go for ceviche. Wow. No. This is true religion. No. This is. No. This is how it's done. We'll show you how it's created. Our culture has it. Our tribe has it. No. We got it over here. We've perfected it. Guess what? None of you have. It's all cultural. It all goes back to some ancient thing where humans were trying to figure out how they got here, why it matters, and how we're supposed to live. Well, we nailed it. No, we did. Hey, let's all fight for millennia about who did. It's cultural. Isn't it freeing? It should be freeing. How do we experience this God? Well, it's through culture, and people experience this God differently through different cultures, and that's okay. So talk to them and find out which God concept they are destroying or freeing themselves from or experiencing. It'll be a much more interesting and productive conversation. I want to end with a little meditation here, and then we're going to sing a couple songs. So this is a meditation. It works really well for me. I usually do it after I run and after yoga. And I'm just going to kind of lead you in it, but then you're going to take over. So close your eyes, not because closing your eyes is sacred, but because closing your eyes eliminates distraction. And here's what I want you to spend some time thinking on, and even saying in your own head. I am grateful for my body. And here are some things that you might be grateful for. Eyes that see. Think of what you've already seen this morning. Ears that hear. Think of music and voices and laughter and crying. Think of a mouth that can taste. Think of your favorite foods. You can almost taste them when you think about it. What a gift that is. Think about digestive systems that digest. Think about legs that allow you to walk and move and run and exercise, and in some cases just get up from the chair and walk to the fridge to taste something else. Think about fingers that type, draw, paint, create, hold another human's hand, touch another human's face, touch another human's hair. Think of lungs that allow you to breathe even though you're not even paying attention. A heart that pumps blood through your entire body, keeping you alive and you don't even know. A brain that's even allowing you to process these words and put them into something more meaningful right now. And go through the list of your body and say, man, I am grateful for this and that and this. I'm grateful even for a body that tells me when it's suffering and when it's hurting and when there's sickness, and then that heals itself. And be grateful for your body for a moment. And then there's all these things outside your body, including other humans, some who are really annoying, be thankful for them that they teach you something. Some who are really comforting, be thankful for them that they comfort and bring you joy. And then there's this universe of clouds and sunsets and trees and snow and pets and wild animals, and salmon. And then there's this world of things that humans have created because we have this capacity to be creative, like trains, and cars, and roads, and lights, and buildings, and chairs that you're sitting on right now, and heating systems that keep you warm right now, and at your home, and carpet, and couches, and mattresses, and pillows. And think of the abundant number of those things that you have, and think of the abundance of beauty in this universe, of stars and moons, of quiet, of light, of darkness, of space, of birds. And go through the list on your own and say, wow, I am grateful for this world I live in. And be specific. I am grateful for birds that wake me up in the morning. I am grateful for that annoying person I work with because they teach me. I am grateful for my parents. I am grateful for my friends. I am grateful for basketball. I am grateful for football. On and on it goes. And then after all of those are running through your mind, I always end with this. And I am most grateful for a God that lives in it all and through it all and soaking in it all. All of those things about my body, God shows up in those. All of those things about the universe, God shows up in those. All of those things about those other people, God shows up in those. And I am so grateful for a divine that is in and through and soaking in all of that. And help me to see more. Help me to reveal more and to be aware of more. Amen.